So if you've just, let me just recap for a few of us that haven't been with us. We're in the book of Nehemiah, and we've seen how Nehemiah has been called to this special project to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. He was a cupbearer to the king at a very prestigious position, but God's call came upon his life, and he gave up that position. He goes to Jerusalem to organize this rebuilding of the wall around Jerusalem. And we've seen this over those last few weeks, a growing opposition. There's these nations around Jerusalem that don't want that wall rebuilt. They don't want Jerusalem to thrive and to have security and to be advancing. And so there's been this growing external opposition, even threatening violence. But this week, we see something completely different that's messing up this building of the wall and the building of the community. It's internal opposition. It's not an external force that's coming against it, but there's internal division that's undermining the project of building the wall and even undermining the health and the life of the community. And so you might just think even to yourself, oftentimes you might have been working on a project or being in a relationship, and sometimes the people you think are certainly on your team or you're on your side, that they do things that undermine the project you're working on, or they undermine you. And so we're looking this morning at this internal opposition. And so it's helpful to think of, we can't just think of, oh, it's the bad people out there that are opposed to us. Well, oftentimes it's the bad people inside the community, inside the church even, that cause the problems. And so Clarissa is going to come and read our passage for us. Great, thank you, Clarissa. So we're going to look at what is this internal conflict? How did the situation occur? And what is the solution? So if you look in verse 1, we see this outcry of one section of the community. There arose this outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers. And then there's, in verses 2 to 4, there's three groups of people spoken about. Each of these verses begins with the same phrase. So there were those who said. So there's those who said, in verse 2, with our sons and our daughters, we are many, so let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive. There's one group of people that doesn't have many resources. They don't have assets or fields, and they're running out of food. They don't have enough food to exist, and so they're raising up this concern, we're starving. What's going to happen to us? The next group in verse 3 says, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine. So these people have assets and that they can use, and so but there's a famine going on in the land as well. And so maybe they planted crops, but those crops haven't grown very much. They haven't gotten a yield out of them. So what they've done is they've borrowed money from some wealthy people in the community. But because of the famine and the conditions, they haven't gotten much of a yield out of those that what they've planted. And so now they're in trouble because they can't pay back these loans, and they've mortgaged the field, and so they're under threat of losing those assets. And then there's another group in verse 4. We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. So not only is there the need to eat, the need to have your livelihood, but there's a tax going on from the king, and so some people are not able to pay that tax. And then verse 5 kind of summarizes those three positions, or summarizes the worst part of those three positions. Now, our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers, our children are as their children, yet we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but it's not in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and vineyards. Debt servitude is not something that it happens for us really at all, but in the ancient Near East, it was not uncommon for that to take place, and that if you've lost your assets, you've lost your fields, you don't have a way to survive, that you would sell yourself, or maybe you'd have to sell your children into slavery to raise money. And so that's threatened on people, or that's actually happened in a few cases. And so that's this outcry of this the of part of the community. And then verses 7 and 8 help us further to really understand what's going on here. Verse 7, Nehemiah said to them, You are exacting interest, each from his brother. What's the commentators differ exactly on what's happening here. And interest is probably involved, but probably something more is involved in terms of those people that said, loan us some money and I'll put my property up on pledge to you. When they weren't able to pay back their debts, these wealthy people that lent them money, they foreclosed on their property. And so they, it's a little bit like the banking situation today, that banks are foreclosing on people's homes. But by doing that, they're taking away all their assets. They're taking away every possible way in which they can be able to live and exist. In a sense, these wealthy people inside the Jerusalem community are acting like pawnbrokers, right? They've given loans on pledge of certain property, and when those loans weren't repaid, they foreclosed. They took their property. There's probably some interest involved as well, but it's this loans and taking of their property that's one of the key problems in the community. And then verse 8 helps us see the moral absurdity of what's going on here. Nehemiah says, "We, as far as we are able, have bought back our Jewish brothers who've been sold to the nation." So part of Nehemiah's program of coming to lead this Jerusalem community is he's trying to buy back people that were sold to Gentile nations so they can be free again and they can be part of the community. But Nehemiah is saying, just while we're trying to buy back these people that have been sold into servitude, you are selling your brothers so that they might even be sold back to us. You're fomenting this problem of people being sold to other nations or having to sell their children to other nations because you foreclosed on their properties. And now you're just increasing the number of Jews that we need to buy back out of slavery. So there's this major conflict that's threatening the building of the wall, but it's also threatening the very health and livelihood of this of the Jerusalem community. So it's not a matter of, but last week we looked at these external nations that are coming to threaten them. And so it's not all a matter of like, well, we're the good people and the bad people out there are trying to afflict us. No, now it's a conflict inside the community. It's the sin inside the community is what is threatening to undo this community. And it's financial in its nature. We'll talk more about this, but it's financial desires or over desires or inappropriate desires are very subtle, right? In some ways, what these wealthy people are doing is not absolutely illegal. It's not completely against the laws of the Old Testament, but it's completely inappropriate in terms of what the context of this community. And in verse 9, Nehemiah just summarizes, it says, "The thing you're doing is not good." So how do we think about this? So it's not good. So you know what? If someone here needs to borrow some money, don't lend them money, or at least don't take their minivan as pledge. And if they can't pay it back, then definitely don't foreclose in their minivan, right? But our culture is in a completely different place, right? We, in a sense, they're so interdependent that they end up having problems. But we're completely dependent upon ourselves, right? In one sense, we'd never ask someone in this room for a loan, right? We'd go to a bank. We keep our own finances very secretive, very silent. We keep ourselves pushed off from each other financially, and so our issues are, in a sense, really different than what theirs are. We have the opposite problem. We never end up talking about money together or what money in a community looks like. So we need to press forward and say, well, let's say, how did this situation occur? What has brought this about? I think there's four failures and then a fifth failure going on here. The first is a failure of worship. If you look at verse 9, Nehemiah says, ought you not to walk in the fear of our God? That phrase, fear of God or fear of the Lord, occurs over 100 times, especially in the Old Testament, to speak about what is it, what's the very nature of worship? What's the very nature of how you live out your faith? It's this ask this phrase, fear of the Lord. Right, the Proverbs talk about it a lot in terms of the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. But in many different ways, it uses this, it's shorthand for what is worship. And so these people had, Nehemiah is saying, you've forgotten the fear of the Lord. What is the fear of the Lord? It's not fear of punishment, right? Fear is not that God would punish us. It's that reverent awe and greatness. It's being properly connecting to the fear of the Lord is realizing we're dependent upon Him, that He is great, that we need to be quiet and let Him lead us. It's responding to God's greatness and majesty. And so if you really feared the Lord, that would impact your conduct. So the way that fear of the Lord is used in the Old Testament, oftentimes it's you need to fear the Lord, that's your proper stance before God. Other times it's if you did fear the Lord, you would act rightly. That the fear of the Lord should lead us to act rightly. And so on the front of your bulletin, the second quote in 1 John says, if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? In a sense, it's a similar idea of if you did fear the Lord, it would impact how you act towards your neighbor. And so the first failure is the failure of worship. But then as well, in verse 7 and 8, there's a failure to remember. Remember God's story and God's instructions. So in verse 8, we saw Nehemiah was buying back these slaves from the other nations. That's actually part of God's law. Part of God's law in Leviticus was if your neighbor is sold into slavery for some reason, you who are able should buy them back. And so Nehemiah is remembering God's story. He's following God's story. And although he's not quoting like I'm obeying the law here, he's doing what the story is all about. He's doing what God's will is. And then as well in verse 7, so it talked about this interest that they're playing the pawnbroker, but there's interest going on as well. Leviticus 25 says there's not supposed to be interest charged in loans between people, between inside of Israel, right? We'll see in a little bit a little further, but one of the interesting things is the Jerusalem community, the Israeli community, God put in all these stories and laws and guidelines for how financiers are supposed to work inside the community so that there would be financial health. So there wouldn't be anyone who was completely poor and destitute. That it doesn't become communism, but it's these guidelines that bound the community in terms of how they're supposed to act. And so these wealthy people, they've forgotten the story. They've forgotten the commands. They've forgotten the borders and the guidelines that God has brought about and given them in the Old Testament. So a failure to remember God's story. It's also a failure of community, right? Clearly, they've been acting as individuals. They haven't thought about we're one people. We're a corporate entity. How are we supposed to act together? What's the health of all of us together? I think what's gone on is they've seen an opportunity, right? They've seen there's a need for loans, there's a financial inequity here, and so being wealthy people, perhaps their mind just thought, oh, there's a market here. I'm going to engage in the market, but their market was at the expense of some of their own people, some of the own people in the Jerusalem community. Perhaps that's similar to the whole mortgage crisis. Right, the people that were making these NINA loans, these no income, no assets asset loans, who people that normally made $80,000 to $100,000 a year, all of a sudden they were making $1 million a year, and yet they thought, you know, this is for me, all right? This is a great opportunity. I can make all this money for me, but they never thought beyond is what I'm doing contributing to something larger? Is it hurting and undermining the whole community in terms of a whole global economy? And they're not only responsible, but obviously that was part of selling these mortgages. It was part of what led to the whole financial collapse. So a failure of community, the wealthy acted as individuals, but also a failure of mission. If you look in verse 9, again, he says, ought you not to walk in the fear of the Lord, fear of our God, to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemy? See, the way Israel was to live out their life, their corporate life together, was part of their witness to the world. In the Old Testament, generally, it's God wants Israel to be this shining light of a unique community where His glory was present, and that people would be drawn, the nations would be drawn into Israel to see and experience that. In the New Testament, it's more that, well, we're supposed to be this community, but we're also called to be sent out to the nations. But so when Nehemiah says to prevent the taunts of the nations, our enemies, he's saying, you've forgotten that that we have a mission here. Part of our mission is being a community that functions well, that loves each other, that does things completely differently. And so they're taking advantage of their brothers is a failure of mission as well. But so why was there a failure of worship, a failure to remember, a failure of community, a failure of mission? I think it comes down to a failure to put financial desires in their proper place. I think these wealthy people saw, you know, there's a market here. And so they just naturally thought, I should take advantage of the market without thinking in terms of the subtlety and the strength of what inappropriate financial desires end up doing. And we've talked about before that the Bible talks more about money than it talks about heaven. And part of the reason for that is that money, over-desire for money can make us myopic. Right? So these wealthy people, they just saw, you know, here's some loaning opportunities. I can double my assets. I can expand my land holdings by loaning money, and if they can't pay, you know, that's business, sorry. And they foreclose on these assets. Inappropriate financial desire leads to, part of the problem is that there's shades of gray, right? Some of what they're doing is not illegal, but it's completely inappropriate. So they didn't see the context, right? These wealthy people who did these loans, they didn't see the context of where they're living and what was the proper faith expression in that environment. Part of the problem with money is that it's not black or white, right? There's all these different shades of gray in terms of, well, is this proper? Is this proper? You do get to a place where, yeah, you shouldn't give a mortgage to someone who has no income and no assets. But most of us struggle in the middle between, well, what is proper and shrewd and wise and faithful, figuring out those shades of gray in the middle. When it comes to financial desires, it's hard to measure unfaithfulness. It's hard to measure actually what's unfaithful. With sexual sin, it's fairly easy, right? If you turn over and you say, oh, you're not my spouse, then you've committed adultery. If you say, oh, this is not my phone, okay, I've stolen something, right? Even jealousy, anger, drunkenness, there's a much easier way to see, have I violated this? But when it comes to greed or over-desire for financial things, it's hard to tell, have I been unfaithful? It's hard to, there isn't so much a tangible line in the sand. And so I think that's another reason why the Bible talks so much about it. But I think it's also that, I think you could say, especially for us, money is stealthier and slipperier than other temptations for us. Right? Money sort of, it kind of sneaks up around the back door and it's like, oh, well, you know, you could have this, you can pursue this. And it can argue with us in ways that we don't know, oh, that's not right. I shouldn't be following that. It's a hard thing to get our hands around. And it takes time for the corruption of greed and inappropriate financial desire to show up. Right? It took the mortgage crisis, it took quite a while. It took, I don't know, a year or so before everything exploded or imploded. So it's ultimately for these people, the thing that leads to this failure to worship, failure to remember, failure of community and mission is this failure to put financial desires in their proper place. James, I think, gives us the third quote in the front page, gives us a helpful just sequence of sometimes how these desires take place. It says, but each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desires. And then desire, when it's conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. There's this sequence. There's this growing of something that starts very small, but that if we let it go, or if we encourage it, it does grow and it develops, and it ends up ultimately in something that James calls death. So that's how this situation occurred. What's the solution that Nehemiah raises for us? So in verses 10 and 11, we see this. So what's interesting is in verse 10, he says, moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let us abandon this exactive interest. I think what Nehemiah is doing is here, he's calling for an end to loans. But what he does first is he says, you know what? I've been loaning money and grain too. I don't think he's been foreclosing on people's pledges. I don't think he's been playing the pawnbroker, but he and his brothers have been loaning money and grain to people. And his solution to the situation is to say, okay, I was wrong in that. What I'm calling for now is all of us to abandon, and so he's let us, right? He's including himself, abandon this exactive interest. So it's not only, again, that's this. These Hebrew words, it's hard to figure exactly what's going on. But it's not only interest. I think he's calling for the end of loans. What he's saying in this context in which we're living right now, we need to give gifts, not loans. We need to take care of those that are poor amongst us. And so that what we need to do now is gifts, not loans. And so, and then in verse 11, he says, so this here, though, is he doesn't include himself in this one, right? It's a second person plural call. Return to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, their houses, and the percentage of money and grain, wine, and oil that you've been exacting from them. So he calls for an end of loans, and then he says, okay, all you wealthy people that took their land, their vineyards, and you've been collecting interest on them, you need to give it all back. You need to give them back the resources in which so that they can survive, so that they have the ability to grow crops and earn money and buy back people that might have been put into debt servitude. So it's those two things. So basically what I think he's calling for is generosity. What's interesting is Nehemiah, he's pulling on some Old Testament ideas, but he's not just quoting the law to them. It's an interesting hermeneutical kind of thing to think about. But he's pulling on Leviticus 25 to implement some of the Old Testament stories about it. But he's not just using the law. He's, I think, calling for this greater idea of generosity in this community at this time. And I think generosity is this theme that runs throughout the scriptures. So if we think about it narratively, in a positive sense, Abraham, when he comes back from rescuing Lot, who was taken, and he has all these goods with him, he gives 10% of everything he has to this pre-existent Christ figure, Melchizedek. And it's kind of an odd thing to know what's going on. But we see Abraham giving to this, in a sense, giving to God, giving to this pre-existent Christ figure, Melchizedek. And then we also see Abraham, when the king of Sodom says, you know, you can keep all my stuff, just give me my people. Abraham says, no, you take your stuff. I don't want you to be able to ever to say you enriched me, because I want to only say God is the one that's enriched me. And so we see Abraham as a positive example of generosity. We see Achan as a negative example. Achan takes these goods of gold and silver that he coveted in Jericho, and he buries them in his tent. And it's his individual sin that undermines the whole community's battle against Ai in a similar way to how these wealthy people here are undermining the community. We see a positive example of generosity in the call for joyful offerings to the tabernacle and the temple. Right? It says, anyone whose heart overjoys is full of joy and wants to give to the building of this tabernacle, the mobile worship site, or the temple, the physical permanent worship site, then please bring your offerings. And it says the workers had to say, okay, stop. Don't bring any more, okay? We have more than enough. It's this example of, it wasn't a command. It was an opportunity to give out of joy. And the people had great joy in the worship of God, and they gave with abundance to both of those projects. In Amos, we have another negative example of condemning people that were living in luxury and ignoring the poor in their community. And then we move into the New Testament. We have in Acts 2, there's this free will offering of selling property and giving it to the apostles so that it might be distributed to those that had physical need. And what that also results in is great mission. At the end of that passage, it says, and the people around them held them in great fear, held them in great respect, and 5,000 people were added that day. So communal financial faithfulness and generosity is an aspect of mission. It was in Acts 2. In Acts 5, there's this dishonesty in offering from Ananias and Sapphira. And then we get this another great narrative piece at the last quote in the front of the bulletin of the churches in Macedonia. Paul writes, "We want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that's been given among the churches of Macedonia, for in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy, their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, as I can testify, and beyond their means, of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. And this not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord, and then by the will of God to us." So what's going on there is that Gentile Christians are bringing collections to give to the poor Jewish Christian, which is a great show of community and reciprocity, because the gospel came from the Jewish Christians to the Gentile Christians. And so it's saying we are all of one group because you brought the gospel to us, and we'll support you in your time of need. And yet the very last sentence says, they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to the will of God to us. Generosity is always comes out of worship. And Paul is testifying to how the Macedonian churches gave out of worship. So narratively, we see this theme of generosity moving through the scriptures. How about commands? In the Old Testament, there's three basic commands for giving. There's tithes, alms, and offerings. So a tithe is giving 10% of the income that you receive back to God's work as a way to say, everything I have has come from you, God, in the first place, and so I'm acknowledging that by giving you 10% of what you end up giving me. The alms are gifts to the poor. It's gifts to those who don't have, who are in great physical need. And then offerings are those things, those special projects, like the building of the tabernacle and the temple. And I think those are very helpful categories. What's interesting is we get to the New Testament, and there is no specific command for those three things. There's examples of it. There's a command to set aside, to bring your offerings weekly to the church or whenever you got paid. But there isn't a specific command. And so people differ with, well, should we just pull the tithe over from the Old Testament? And there's one passage where Jesus talks to Pharisees that that kind of supports that idea. Other people say no. There's this new freedom in the New Testament apart from command, and so there's this still this call for generosity, but But precisely the command of that is not present. It's hard to know the best way to put those two together. And yet I think the thing that makes a lot of sense to me is if in the Old Testament Israel had this much of an understanding of who God was, of his plan for the world, of the promises that God was going to bring, and he called for them to give 10% of their income to acknowledge him. In the New Testament, when we have this much, when we have Jesus coming and living amongst us, showing us who God is, being that the fulfillment of that promise, of living for us, of dying for us, of rising again for us, that it would seem that if 10% was appropriate in this concept, that to move to the bigger picture of that we have this weightier, bigger, more detailed, full picture of God's promise, that generosity shouldn't be less than 10%. And so I think the tithe is in the New Testament. I think that the legality of the tithe is not meant to be present, because the Pharisees say it's possible to tithe on everything and your heart still be very, very far from God. And so that's not what's wanted at all. But in terms of the sweep of we have more than what they had, and so the desire to give more should be present. And so the rest of this passage printed is Nehemiah. He calls for generosity. The scriptures call for generosity. Then Nehemiah shows us his generosity. So in verse 14 he says, "Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor." The first thing we see there is Nehemiah had this long-term practice of over 12 years of he chose not to take an allowance that legally he could have taken. It's kind of part of his financial package. He said, I'm not going to take this food allowance because, we'll see in a second why he says that, but because it would be burdensome to the people. And so, one, he doesn't take the food allowance that he normally would. The former governors ended up taking it. At the end of verse 15, he says why he doesn't do that. "But I did not do so because of fear of God." Right? It's that, in a sense, this is the first great commandment, right? The fear of the Lord kind of connects with what's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. Nehemiah loves God, and so he says, I think it's an act of worship for me not to take this part of what rightfully would be mine financially. And then verse 16, he continues, "I persevered in the work. I acquired no land." And then he says, "But also beyond that, I fed, it looks like 150 plus people every day out of my own expense." So Nehemiah must have been someone who had wealth and had resources. And so he doesn't take the food allowance, but he still feeds all these people. And at the end of verse 18, it says why he does that, which is really, I think, the second great commandment. "Because the service was too heavy on this people." In a sense, he's saying, love your neighbor as yourself. Or even in gospel terms, love your neighbor as Jesus has loved you. And so we see for Nehemiah this generosity of him calling for generosity in the community and him living out generosity in the community. And that really, he's almost abridging from the Old Testament to the New Testament in terms of this call for generosity. And so I thought it'd be helpful just to say, Nehemiah says what he does, what do the Durhams do? We've been at, like many of you probably have been, and if you're young enough, you will be at some point. You'll be at places where you have almost nothing, and you'll be at places where you live much more comfortably. There was a time when I was an intern in New York City, and I made $12,000 a year. And exactly. And we had no choice, but we had to live with Kathy's parents. And there was good things that came with that, but there was a lot of hard things also that came with that. So for 3 years, we lived with them. And so that was a very lean time, and yet God provided for us. And so as God's increased our income beyond $12,000 a year. He's what we've always done is to say we do want to honor God as saying everything we have comes from you. And so we calculate 10% to give to God's church out of that. And then beyond that, we give generously without counting to other things. It depends on what comes in and what the situations are and what God shows us. But for us, it's worked well to say, let's be thoughtful in this side and let's give 10% of everything that comes in. And then, you know, as opportunities come up, let's just be generous. Let's give because God's given us so much. And so to give without counting, without calculating, but to give as God calls, as he gives, shows us needs, as he puts, lays that on our hearts to give joyfully. So this situation in Jerusalem was, there was this internal conflict and it was financial. And we also struggle with financial temptations, financial issues. But Nehemiah's call to them was generosity. Generosity beyond what was absolutely required. Generosity because of the needs of the people. Generosity out of worship. Generosity out of mission. Out of a sense of community. God's made us to be one people. So may God give us his spirit to enable us to be generous.